Welcome to another broadcast of Crime Beat with Ron Chepsik, the show that puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Crime Beat brings you a lineup of dynamic and provocative guests who allow you to experience their lives and learn more about crime. Al Proffitt, the noted crime documentarian, says, quote, "Crime Beat is the best show of its kind for the thinking listener, both entertaining and educational." Let me introduce the host of Crime Beat. A native of Thunder Bay, Canada, Ron Chepsik is an award-winning author, documentary producer and director, publisher and screenwriter. He's the author of more than 36 books and 4,000 published magazine, newspaper, and internet articles. Ron is a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, was a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series, and has worked as an instructor in UCLA's Extension Journalism program. Four of Ron's books and several of his screenplays have been optioned for movies. For more information, visit ronchepsik.com. Given his publications, extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Here he is, your host, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott, for that nice introduction. Good evening, world, wherever you are tonight. Well, early this morning, there were recorded 1.2 million cases of the coronavirus. We had 75,000 plus deaths here in the U.S., and it's predicting 100,000 by the end of May. I think that might be low at the current rate. Another week and the coronavirus is still here and no end in sight. Yet, I still don't know anybody who has the virus. Do you, Scott?
Yes, I have. There's been a few deaths in our community of the people, and I did know these people.
Wow, wow. That's really sad. Yeah, but they've been doing a pretty good job here, I think, in South Carolina. And we have the White House who rejects CDC recommendations for reopening. I think they think they know better than the scientists, right?
Well, they know it's just going to magically go away.
Yeah, magically. It's going to disappear. It's the way our fearless leader said. Anyways, we'll have to live with that. But we got a great show tonight. We have Steve Hodell, and we're going to discuss his book, Black Dahlia Avenger, A Genius for Murder, The True Story. In 1947, the brutal sadistic murder of a beautiful young woman named Elizabeth Short led to the largest manhunt in L.A. history. The killer teased and taunted the police and public for weeks, but his identity stayed a mystery, and the murder remained the most tantalizing unsolved case of the last century, until his book revealed the bizarre solution. Steve Hodell, Steve Hodell, a retired LAPD detective, took up the case, reviewing the original evidence and records, as well as those of a separate grand jury investigation into a series of murders of single women in L.A. at the time. The prime suspect had, in fact, been identified, but never indicted. Why? And who was he? Steve Hodell's research shows that the murder of a true-life Jekyll and Hyde, who was a respected, highly respected member of society by day and a psychopathic killer by night, was his own father. Wow. Amazing twist of the story. We'll hear more, and we'll be with Steve Hodell shortly to discuss this fascinating case. But first, let's take care of business. Our acknowledgments to the people helping make Crime Beat one of the most popular shows on the Internet. First, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there from around the world for tuning into Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. Some of our shows are averaging now between 150,000 and 200,000 listeners every week from more than 160 countries around the globe. All shows are free and downloadable. You miss a live show, go to the artistfirst.com website to listen to it. You can take our shows and post them on the web on any website. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Strategic Books, for supporting our show. Thanks also to production people of the Artist First Radio Network. We have special thanks to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their great music for our theme song. It's got the beat to crime written all over it. Now let's look at mailbag for this week. We continue to get mail from all over the world. Some comments are long, so we added them for length. We had a lot of emails last week because of the topic. This one was from Jerry, which I received on my Facebook page, and it was pretty typical. Jerry wrote, "Thanks, Ron, for the show on Donald Trump. It was a real eye-opener. I hope people were listening." Of course, we were discussing Steve Hassan, the cult of Trump. A leading cult expert explained how the president uses mind control. And it was really an incredible discussion, a really eye-opening. And if you want to listen to it, you go to the artistfirst.com website, and the show has been archived. We encourage you to continue emailing us with your comments and suggestions. You can do that at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. That's crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Tell us if you don't want to use your name, no problem. So what have you been up to? Go to the www.strategicmediabooks.com website. We have several books coming out. I know a couple of them would interest you. Personal level, I just finished the script. I walked on my own grave. It was based on a show from last October with Ramon Sosa. I optioned the book. I'm real excited about it. I got a recommend in coverage, and I'm sending it out now to producers. We'll see what will happen, and I'll let you know. We offer affordable advertising opportunities for sponsored authors. We have several packages to meet your budget. You can contact us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Now let's look at next week's show. The hits just keep coming. On May 14th, we go across the pond to England and a discussion with publisher and investigative journalist Peter Walsh about his book, Drug War, The Secret History. Peter runs Milo Books. It's one of the big true crime publishers in England. He's published two of my books. He bought the British rights to two of my books, and it's going to be nice talking to him again. Let's look at the news for this week. We call this a rap sheet part of our program. A rap sheet features a couple items in the news that caught our attention and you might have missed. Well, you think you're going crazy from the coronavirus lockdown. While we have conspiracy theorists, Alex Jones can probably top whatever disturbing thoughts you might be having. He said on his far-right radio talk show last week that he's willing to go full cannibal. That's right. He wants to eat people. Yes, if COVID-19 shuts down, continue, he said, he has, quote, extrapolated this out and may have to resort to drastic and disgusting methods of survival. Here's what he said. I'll admit it. I will be eat my neighbors. I won't have to do for a few years because I got food and stuff. But I'm really looking at my neighbors now and going, I'm ready to hang them out and gut them and skin them. My daughters aren't starved to death. I'll eat my neighbors. I will. Although Jones' admission can make neighborhood watch meetings awkward, he said he plans on gobbling globalists who impose the lockdowns first. It's unlikely Jones ever go hungry, of course, thanks to a fortune amassed in part through scams like selling fake coronavirus cures. He's a real con man. He was ordered to pay Sandy Hook Elementary School parents $100,000 for legal fees last year in a lawsuit they filed over his lies that the 2012 school massacre was a hoax. Well, if Jones is serious, Scott, he's truly a wacko. It's scary that there may be people out there who will follow Jones' example.
Yeah, I saw that clip of him going through that, and I thought, you know, I got a couple neighbors that you could probably live off of for several years.
Well, I think Alex better watch it, too. He looks like a good candidate for the table on that. But anyways, this other story is typical. It shows the airline industry is changing big time. We have Southwest Airlines Company will join other airlines in requiring passengers and customer-facing employees to wear face masks starting May 11th amid safety concerns during the COVID-19 pandemic. The air carrier said it will provide a face covering to passengers who don't bring their own. The air carrier said starting May 2nd, it will reduce temporarily the total number of passengers seated on its planes, and boarding and deplaned procedures will be modified to maintain social distancing. I fly American Airlines because the hub is in Charlotte, which is about, the airport's about 30 minutes from me on that, and they're doing the same thing. Looks like it's going to be a new year for air travel, Scott.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a long time before air travel comes back. If you see, Warren Buffett got rid of all his airline stock.
Yeah, and I'd really be scared if I was in the airline industry, because he's usually really a sharp investor, right?
Yes, he is.
Yeah. Well, that's it for the rap sheet part of the program for this week. We'll be with our guest, Steve Hodell, shortly, but we will take a station identification break, and we'll be back.
You are listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network. Send us your questions and comments to crimebeat123@yahoo.com. Back to your host, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott. Tonight we welcome Steve Hodell for a discussion of his book, Black Dahlia Avenger, A Genius for Murder, The True Story. Steve Hodell was born and raised in L.A., California. He served 4 years as a medic in the U.S. Navy and then joined the Los Angeles Police Department in 1963. After 6 years in uniform patrol, he transferred to Hollywood Division Detectives, where he worked all of the tables, burglary, robbery, auto theft, theft, juvenile crimes against persons, and then was permanently assigned to the homicide detail. The book we will discuss tonight was nominated for by the Mystery Writers of America as a Best Fact True Crime Book. That's a real honor. And with no further ado, we welcome Steve Hodell to the show. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Ron. Thanks. Good to be with you.
Great. Yeah. Well, you know, we got to start off with our guests and ask them how you've been dealing with the coronavirus. You're out in L.A., right?
I'm in L.A. and hunkered down. But, you know, that's one of the things writers do a lot. So it's, you know, as unpleasant as it's been, I'm kind of used to it. But I'm going to pass on the cannibalism. I'm going to stick to macaroni and cheese, I think.
Yeah, I think that macaroni and cheese would be much more tastier. On that.
Right.
Yeah, but you know, Gavin Newsom seems to be got a good handle on the situation. Your deaths are really low compared to some other states like New York and Illinois.
Yeah, he jumped on it real quick and shut things down. And it's considering how large we are, it seems to be going pretty good, really. You know, following his requests, and it's working out pretty good.
Right. Well, thanks for sending that YouTube submission. It's really ironic because I just started watching Bosch, which is on Amazon. You folks out there, it's a true crime detective series based on Michael Connelly's books. He did several books on Hieronymus Bosch. And so you learned how to do the Bossa Nova.
Yeah, that was fun. I put together a 15-minute YouTube video just laying out the ironic similarities between my career and Harry Bosch's. It was a lot of fun, and it wasn't something that Michael Connelly consciously wrote. It just that everything fell into place.
It was really eye-opening. I mean, there was like 13, I think, what you call synchronicities, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, everything. Bosch was born in the same hospital, you know, growing up and placed in detention in juvenile hall for child endangerment. All just goes on and on, and both in the service and both made Detective 3 at Hollywood, and it's pretty amazing, all the linkage, and it was all just kind of, like you say, a kind of happenstance.
Well, you're kind of a celebrity now. I mean, it's really amazing, and it's kind of ironic because your father, I mean, you I think, you know, what I read, and I'm just getting into the case, you present a compelling argument that your father was the murderer.
Yeah, we're really way behind it. You know, initially, I mean, of course, you know, now we're five books later, and really it's just one book. It's really one ongoing investigation, and just, you know, doors kept opening and one after the other, and we're so far, there's so much that's piled up now that we've been able to find that it's really beyond any reasonable doubt. I mean, you know, like the head one of the head DAs here says, he could convict in a hot second now. With the
right on that. Yeah, how many years have you been researching the case?
Well, So I don't, if you want me to give you a little bio on me, you laid it out. So basically, when I retired, my career was from 63 to 86, almost 24 years. And then I retired in 86 and kind of was part of that mass exit from L.A. and went up, raised my two sons were small, 5 and 7, and raised them in Bellingham, Washington, which is like the last stop before Canada. And basically, I was doing PI work up there, and I'd had over 300 murder investigations during my career. So, and one of the highest clearance rates on the force. So, you know, I was long retired, happily retired, 14 years into retirement. And this thing came to me just out of nowhere, literally. I had no previous exposure to it. I'd never been involved in any of the investigation on the job or anything. And I got that 3 a.m. phone call from my stepmother in San Francisco. And she said, your father's, you know, the paramedics are here. Your father's just collapsed, had a heart attack. They just pronounced him dead. Come down. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I jumped on a plane, flew down, did all the things you have to do to take care of the passing of a father, parent. And, you know, and kind of, you kind of have to, you know, I spend the first third of the book talking about his biographics, because he was such a remarkable human being. And I don't know if you want me to go into that now.
We'll talk a little bit later, but just continue with this. It's interesting.
Okay, so I get the, I'm talking about the great man's passing with her, and the second day I'm there, she comes out and she hands me a small photo album, like 4x5-inch photo album, and she says, "I think your father would want you to have this." And I start looking through it, and then it's pictures of my family and my mother, my brothers, and stuff. And Man Ray, I don't know if you know who Man Ray was.
Ray, photographer, or painter, right?
Yeah, surrealist photographer. A lot of photos by him in there of us family. He was our family photographer.
Yeah.
And I open it up, and here's an attractive young woman, obviously nude from the waist up, reclining, and I turned to June, my father's wife and widow, and I said, "Who's this, June?" She says, "I don't know, somebody your father knew from a long time ago." Mm-hmm. And I looked at it, and for some reason, and to this day, Ron, I don't know why, but Black Dahlia comes to mind, and it may have been, they did a movie in 75 called Who is the Black Dahlia? With Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and I'm blanking on the girl's name. But anyway, it looked a lot like her, and it just came and went. I didn't think much of it. So then 2 days later, I'm on the phone with my half-sister, Tamar, who's living in Hawaii, and we're talking about the great man's, remarkable life, and I had become very close to him, and he had been gone to Asia and the Far East for 35, 40 years, and came back. In the last 10 years of his life, he relocated to San Francisco, and I came down, and he came up, and we were very close, and So we're talking about him, and out of nowhere, Tamar says to me, "Well, he was a suspect in the Black Dahlia murder." And I said, "What the hell are you talking about, Tamar?" I said, "Where the hell is this coming from?" Well, Tamar and I had like 20 minutes of conversations in the previous 50 years. She had been the victim of, as we'll get into the story here, she had been the victim of incest with my father, and there was a big trial and everything. And she kind of spun out of control, sex, drugs, rock and roll, hungry eye, all of that. And I became the black sheep of the family, became a cop. So we really hadn't spoken. But I said, "Well, where is this coming from?" She says, "Well, during the incest trial, the cops that took me back and forth to the court said that they thought he was the Black Dahlia killer." But she says, "He didn't do it," she says, "but they just thought he was a suspect." I says, "Well, there's no way." So basically, that got me to look. I said, "Well, there's no way I'll be able to establish my father had nothing to do with that at all." So initially, when I started out, I had no doubt at all I'd be exonerating him in a hot second with my background. Right. So I had at that point, I was divorced, and my girlfriend was living in L.A., and I had her send me up, and I knew nothing about the case. I didn't even know the victim's name. This was a case from 1947, and I was, in the 60s. I was concerned about the present and the future, not the past. I knew it was a famous unsolved case, but I didn't even know her name. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she starts sending me up articles from UCLA Library and papers and originals, and next thing that happens is she sends me up the front page, and it turns out the killer on the Black Dahlia was taunting the police, and he sent in cut and paste notes, catch me if you can type stuff, and one of these he says, "Turning myself in on January 29th, had my fun at the police," and signs it Black Dahlia Avenger. And I look at that, and this is undisguised handwriting, and I look at it, and it's my father's handwriting. And your parents' handwriting, your listeners know their parents' handwriting, and I know my father's. And I said, "Well, wait a minute. There's no way this could be. Did he know the guy? Is he pretending? What the hell's going on?" Anyway, and then I started doing a little research on it, and found out that it was a surgeon that committed the crime. It was a horrible crime. One of the reasons it became so notorious was because of the sadism and the brutality, and she was posed in a vacant lot nude and biceps.
Her body was put in two.
Yeah, and it was just, sexual assault and posed and cut in half surgically. So they knew from the get-go that it was a skilled surgeon or somebody with a high degree of medical finesse. So, well, Dad, I knew Dad had been a surgeon in his early days of doctoring, but I said, still, no way. But I also said to myself, I can't do an absentee investigation from Bellingham. So I relocated back to L.A. in 2000 and started in the next 3 years. I started my investigation, and doors kept opening, and I was sure I'd be able to establish he had nothing to do with it. And guess what? It took me 180 degrees in the other direction. I made the mistake of following the evidence.
And you're still finding new evidence, aren't you?
Recently, major evidence that last year. I just, keeps happening. That's why there's five books. It's really one ongoing investigation, but I keep updating it. And a lot of it has come from, I do a blog site and my website and, emails and stuff from readers, followers, it's just been amazing because how much it's how far it's gone in and that's why we're now at the 20th year and five books later, and we're any doubt.
What's really amazing is, she's just a simple woman, came to L.A., wanted to be an actress and all that. How do you explain this fascination with her? I mean, it's the most famous unsolved case in California history.
It is. The Black Dahlia, her real name was Elizabeth Short. She had four sisters. There were five girls. She was from Medford, Massachusetts, and dropped out of high school. And this is during the war, initially,
right,
when she left. And, there are all of these myths, and I spend a lot of time. Her character was assassinated, by these hack writers over the years, and the myths that developed. They said she was a prostitute and a druggie, and none of that's true. She was a naive young girl looking to fall in love. This is wartime, looking to fall in love with Lieutenant Wright and live happily ever after. And that's she came out to California and L.A. in these shark-infested waters, and caught up with a whole wrong crowd and stuff, and it's a very, very sad story. As to why it became what it became, you kind of have to understand the history of Los Angeles at the time. Mm-hmm. And, so you have this young, beautiful woman coming out to Los Angeles. The myth is that she was looking to get into pictures. That's not true, but anyway, that's the myth that became. She's looking to get into pictures, and she's a beautiful woman, and her nude body is bisected and tortured and posed on a vacant lot, not dumped or anything, but carefully posed on a vacant lot. And then there was the name, Black Dahlia. And that actually came from, the myth is that the reporters created it. No, they didn't. It was actually taken from, there was a film that came out that year, in 46, actually, a few months before, called The Blue Dahlia, with Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake, and it was a noir film. And she used to go into, in Long Beach, she used to go into a soda fountain there, pharmacy for soda fountain, and the military guys there called her, they came up with a nickname, Black Dahlia, and it was a spinoff of The Blue Dahlia, that film, but actually the Blue Dahlia was a bar, not a woman, but anyway, that name, so, it came together, and the horror of it, you got these veteran homicide detectives responding to this vacant lot from a neighbor call, and they get out there and they see this horrible sight, and everything came together, the name, the brutality of the crime, and you had the six newspapers back then in L.A. that were vying for the scoops. So, it all came together, and it's been an ongoing, and then myths developed from there. And one of my problems in working the case from the get-go was I had to separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. There was so much fiction and myth built around it that normally on a homicide you go out and you start with a blank, kind of a tabula rasa and go forward. But with this one, there was so much crap, stacked on top of it. I had to separate the truth from the fiction.
Well, I think the name Black Dahlia really, makes it really sensational, and that probably helped the notoriety of the case. Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. It was headlines.
I mean, I don't think it would be as big if there was no Black Dahlia attached to it.
No, you're right. It was, sensationalized, and the headlines, it was above the fold on newspapers for like 45 days straight.
Right. On that. What was she doing that night? Has that been determined?
Well, yeah. So basically, the myth is that we know that, when they got into it, they found out that she was running in fear of her life, and that she went down to San Diego and stayed there for, this is in the month before she was murdered. Mm-hmm. She was staying in San Diego, kind of hiding out. She was staying with a mother and daughter named the Frenches, who had befriended her. And she decided she was going to come back to L.A. So she called a guy that she'd met down there, a boyfriend, mm-hmm. and he gave her a ride, a guy named Robert Red Manley, gave her a ride back to L.A., and she dropped off her personal luggage, a suitcase and stuff, at the bus station locker. And then she asked him, she said she was going to meet her sister at the Biltmore Hotel, which mm-hmm. is one of our fancier hotels here in downtown L.A. Mm-hmm. So Red takes her to the Biltmore and drops her off there and waits with her for a little bit. And mm-hmm. she says, oh, you can leave. My sister's coming from San Francisco to pick me up. So he splits and leaves, and then she's there for an hour or two. Some of the staff there see her make a phone call or two. She's a very attractive woman, well-dressed. And then, as the myth has it, she walked out the door and the Olive Street side into the fog and was never seen again for a week. And then, because that was the 9th of January, and then on the 15th, they get this call to the vacant lot with this bisected nude body. So the whole missing week, once I got into the weeds of it, I was able to establish there was no missing week. 14 witnesses saw her every day of that week in Hollywood, downtown L.A., and anyway, I present all of that evidence and stuff. So the missing week simply didn't exist, and actually the last person to see her was a police woman the night she was
remembered. She remembered her, but she didn't remember the person she was with, right?
Right. She said, well, she saw her come out of a bar. Well, she saw her on two occasions on the night of her murder. The first in the afternoon, downtown L.A., she came out, she came running up to her and said, there's this man that's threatened to kill me. Mm-hmm. He's in the bar. And so the policewoman, Merle McBride, a beat officer downtown, goes mm-hmm. with her, and they go into the bar. Well, he's gone, but her purse is there. She recovers her purse, thanks the policewoman. Policewoman mm-hmm. leaves. And about an hour and a half, 2 hours later, she is walking her beat, and she looks up and she mm-hmm. sees Elizabeth Short with two men and a woman come out of another bar. And she walks up to her and says, are you all right? She says, oh, yeah, I'm going to meet my father at the bus station. He's coming to pick me up. I'm fine. So she... Mm-hmm. That's it. So she doesn't, you're right, she doesn't have much of a description other than there were two men and a woman. And but there's no question that it was Elizabeth Short. I actually interviewed Merle McBride 50 years later after she's long retired. And,
that's amazing. She was still alive.
Yeah. Well, she was a young officer at the time in 47 on the job, but long retired.
Okay.
And,
can you go ahead?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, do you know what your father was doing that night?
Well, no, of course not. There's no way I could track him down. But what we do know...
Any way that you connected him to her in any way?
Eventually what happened was, this photograph, I look at the photograph in the album, mm-hmm. this reclining nude, and it looks very much like Elizabeth Short. And like I said, this comes and goes. And I say to myself, well, this connects the two of them, Well, that was one of the main controversies initially when I started getting into the investigation, And a lot of people said, no, it's not her, it's somebody else, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I mean, I can't say 100% that it's her, but it was one of the catalysts that started me down the road. And ultimately, what would happen would be that we, once my book came out and I presented all the evidence, and I went in secret to head Deputy District Attorney Steve Kay, who was still on the job, and he reviewed all of my investigation and evidence and linkage. And the other thing, the shocking thing that I discovered was that this wasn't a standalone murder. That was the second myth. You know, the department policy was, oh, it's a standalone, none before, none after. Well, in fact, L.A. had like a dozen lone woman murders, all in a tight geographical pattern between Hollywood and downtown back then. You know, and some of them were posed on vacant lots and murdered, all kinds of different murders, and none of them were being solved. So what happened was, and you got to understand, Ron, that L.A. was a very different back then. It was right. There was a lot of corruption. LAPD was, you know, half the officers were on the take. It was a real-life L.A. Confidential type of thing back then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, payoffs and the cops were involved with everything from, you know, abortion ring, heading abortion rings, which, of course, was a felony back then, and payoffs to murder, and you had it all. So a very different time, and basically that's why you kind of have to understand Dad and his background to see how he's connected with the corruption of Los Angeles at the time. And you want me to give you a quick brief bio?
We can get into it, but I'm curious because, you know, you sound like a detective. You know, you're explaining the case and, you know, right. Like you're working your job and all that. So how did you feel? I mean, did you have any emotion to realize that your father could have been a brutal killer, maybe a serial killer?
Well, like I say, initially I was going to establish he had nothing to do with it. I would be right. able to exonerate him. So, because I was very close to him and he was very close right. to me. In that last decade of his life, we had a chance to, you know, we'd been estranged for a long time, but and I had seen him through the years as a, fates would have it, as a, in the military, I was stationed in the Philippines, and I actually saw him during that two-year billet over there. But anyway, yeah, and so, you know, initially you've got the objective, trained detective who knows what the hell he's doing on murder investigations, having 300 murders under his belt, and then you've got the son who loves his father. So from the get-go, you've got this kind of, you know, conflict, really. Mm-hmm. And I recognized, you know, there's no way I have to keep them separate. I have to keep the, you know, I can't let the love of my father, you know, contaminate my investigation, and I can't let the detective contaminate the son. So basically, it was a divided thing. And the other thing was, it wasn't just that I was looking into the murder. I also knew very little about my father's real background, especially his early years and stuff, you know. And so as a son, I was curious to find out as much as I could in talking with people who knew him from the old days and stuff. So it was a son's search for the truth of who his father was, this remarkable man who's had a life of, you know, larger than life existence. And then there was the detective that was going to show that he had nothing to do with the crime and be able to follow the evidence and eliminate him as from any, you know, suspicion. So I was divided, but at the same time, you know, as a homicide detective, you kind of have to do that in every case you go on. You know,
right.
you get a call in at 3 in the morning, you go in, and they got the suspect in custody, and he's just beaten to death his 6-year-old son or daughter. And you have to sit down with him, give him a cup of coffee, give him a cigarette, and, you know, you can't go in there in rage and anger. You have to, you know... be calm and collected and divide your emotions and say, you know, I'm sure there's some reason for this. Let's talk about it, you know.
Right.
So in a way, in almost every case you have to do that.
Exactly. We're going to get back and discuss some of the evidence relating to the case. We're going to take a break, run a few commercials, and we'll be back shortly. Scott?
Hi, I'm James Baller of Artist First Radio, and I would like to tell you about a fascinating new book from Crime Beat's Ron Chepsik and co-author Mike Rowe. It's titled Robin Hood of the Hood, The Life and Times of Teddy Rowe, Policy Kingpin, and it's published by Strategic Media Books. The book is a historical account of Theodore Teddy Rowe, who courageously fought the Chicago Mafia, more commonly known as the Outfit, for control of the lucrative policy racket in the Windy City. Policy, often called the numbers, is a form of illegal gambling or illegal lottery, played mostly in poor and working-class neighborhoods in the United States. In policy, a bettor attempts to pick three digits to match those that will be randomly drawn the following day. For decades, policy had been a staple in the black community, but when the white mob flexed its power in the late 1940s, many policy kings knuckled under the pressure. Not Teddy Rowe. Rowe famously told mob bosses that he'd rather die than give up control of his operation. Robin Hood of the Hood chronicles an exciting chapter of Chicago history. Go to the Kindle store at Amazon and buy it for just $2.99. For information about this book and other titles, please go to strategicmediabooks.com. That's strategicmediabooks.com.
You are listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network. Let's get back to your host, Mr. Ron Chepsik.
Thank you, Scott. We're here with Steve Hodell, the author of The Black Dahlia Avenger, A True Story. And Steve, the book is available everywhere, right? Our listeners can go out to Amazon,
yeah,
bookstore.
Yeah, you can get it anywhere. There's also the audio book or print, paperback, or ebook, whatever you want. And all five books are available pretty much anywhere you want. Yeah.
Well, your initial book, this is a revised edition, the edition that I'm reading. It was a New York Times bestseller. I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, come on here. I ask people that. I see somebody on my show, and I say, he's a New York Times bestseller. Does it do anything for you? And what's involved in being a New York Times bestseller?
Yeah. Well, it's a numbers game. When the book first came out, I had done a number of documentaries. Dateline and 48 Hours and... So they came out at kind of simultaneous. So that, really helps a lot because it exposes you to a much wider audience, Mm-hmm. And so with the Dateline piece, it's just a numbers game. It got to it got as high as number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list and bestseller in LA and stuff. But it's just because a lot of people had seen the Dateline show and my interviews and stuff and mm-hmm. I've done literally. The book took off, and it was very compelling because I got all kinds of mixed reviews. I mean, I got really good reviews on the written book, but you've got all of these Dahlia theorists out there, and frankly, all kinds of you got from 1947 forward, and they all had their positions and their suspects and all this crap, and it was like. You got a large crowd out there that says, don't mess with my myth. They didn't want it solved. There's a whole group out there that says, no, you're going to take the magic away from it if you solve it. It's what makes it so great is it's unsolved. So you got that group, and then you got others with other theories and stuff. So, but what I did was I went to, after I put it all together, and there's so much evidence, and I went in secret to the head DA who was active on LADA's office, a guy named Steve Kay. And he reviewed it for like 4 months and came back. And as I said, I presented about 8 or 10 different lone woman murders. It wasn't just the Dahlia, but, connected. And he comes back and says, okay, here's the deal. He says, I would, based on your investigation and evidence, I would formally file 2 counts of murder against Dr. George Hill Hodell. And the first would be on the Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short. And the second would be on a murder that occurred, a Jean French murder known as the Red Lipstick, which occurred 3 weeks after the Dahlia murder. Mm-hmm. Her body was posed on a lot. The killer wrote in lipstick on her nude body an obscenity, F-U, signed it B-D for Black Dahlia. So clearly those two were connected. And he says, the others, you're probably right on some of them or all of them. He says, but not enough for I have a strict filing policy. So with that, go ahead.
And also, you're very active on Facebook, and are you active on Twitter as well?
Yeah, not so much on Twitter. I do tweet out. What I do is I have my main blog site, website, is steveodell.com, and then I have a blog on there, and I keep that up regular and update it with all the new information, and I also am on Facebook. But the blog site is where I keep updating my readers on the new evidence and stuff. And but the big thing, I mean, as far as evidence is concerned, what happened was the book comes out and there's all kinds of controversy and sort, you know, a whole bunch of people are saying, oh, this is a Daddy Dearest thing. You know, he hates his father. And in fact, I loved my father. And a bunch of that, you know, all kinds of opinions and stuff. Well, what happened was one of our top journalists here, Steve Lopez, who works for the LA Times, he's got a column, very popular. I had given him a heads up just as the book was coming out. And so he goes to LAPD and says, hey, there's this Odell guy, says his daddy's a Black Dahlia killer, yada, yada. And they said, go away, we don't talk about unsolved cases, you know. So Lopez goes to the DA, Steve Cooley, and says, hey, Odell, and he claims his father, but Cooley, the DA, says, well, I ain't spending a dime of taxpayers' money on a 60-year-old unsolved. But he says, you know, there is a file in the vault, he says, on the Black Dahlia. Would you want to see that? Lopez says, yeah. So they go down to the vault. They unlock it. He takes his box out, gives it to Lopez. He goes upstairs in the DA's office, sits down, opens up the box. Out falls a picture of Dr. George Hill Odell. He goes, whoa. He says, whoa, he was a suspect. Anyway, come to find out, to make a long story short, to make it, he was the prime suspect all along. And they locked away these files, and they had tape record. What they did was they picked up my dad in 1950, took him into the Hall of Justice. Well, I got him there. They sent out a team of detectives to our house, and we lived in this Frank Lloyd Wright Jr. Mayan temple in this amazing house, which is a character in the story itself. It's just an incredible home, very famous. It's called the Soden House in Hollywood. Anyway, they break in while they got Dad in custody. They wire the place for sound. In other words, not telephone taps, but they actually put live microphones in the walls. Mm-hmm. In the living room, in the bedroom, and they run a hard line to the Pactel lines, telephone lines, and they run that to Hollywood Police Station, sit in the basement for the next 6 weeks, 24/7, 18 detectives around the clock, and listen to my father talking in conversations. And basically, it's a 146-page transcript, which I was allowed to actually once locate. Pez found it. I approached Cooley and said, well, can I review the material? He said, yeah, I guess so. So I copied everything, and Lopez did a couple of quick short articles and said, well, his father was a suspect, blah, blah, blah. But he didn't really get into the weeds of it. So I spent the next 3 or 4 months going through these about 900 pages of Odell-related connections, and I add that to the book in the paperback that came out. And anyway, Dad confesses to the crime on tape. These guys are staked out in the basement listening to the conversations. He's talking to this Baron Haringa, and he's saying to the Baron, who's a friend of his, well, supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia, they can't prove it now. My secretary's dead. Well, it turns out he'd been investigated by LAPD a year and a half earlier for the murder of the suspected overdose murder of his secretary. They couldn't prove overdose, and Dad fled the country at that time for a short period to China, so that ended the investigation. But they were sure that he had probably overdosed her, but couldn't prove it. So anyway, and he goes on, talks about performing abortions, and he talks about and Dad, like I say, we haven't had a chance to talk about him, but he was at that time the head of LA County Health Department. He was the VD, venereal disease czar for Los Angeles at the time. So he knew he had all these sensitive files on all the politicians. He was well-connected. He was basically large and in charge. He was untouchable, you know. But the real kicker, and this is where, you know, this is really what, you know, you say, well, why would they lock this away if they had him nailed as the suspect?
Yeah.
Well, what happened was on day three of the stakeout, and I'm reading this from the transcripts, Ron, and I can't believe it. Mm-hmm. I'm reading this, and the detectives, you know, the transcript says, Odell and this Baron Haringa go downstairs to the basement. An object is heard striking. A woman screams. More blows, more screams. And I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, what the hell? They're 4 minutes away at the station. Why aren't they out the door, over to the house, and doing a rescue? They do nothing, these two cops that are staked out. And basically, you know, so at the very least, it was a serious felony assault, but I'm absolutely convinced it was a murder because we hear them saying afterwards, after the blows, don't leave a trace of anything. So here, what you've got here is a, you know, a basically a murder, tape-recorded murder, and you kind of have to understand the timing of it all. Chief Parker, who was our famous, most famous police chief, was literally weeks away from taking command and becoming the next chief of police. And I think what they did was they made this kind of Machiavellian decision to lock it down, shut it down, and, you know, and Dad split the country. I mean, he immediately split after that. And so they, you know, I think they said to themselves, look, he's in the wind. Maybe we can find him. Maybe we can't. We want to clean up Dodge. Let's lock this away for now and do what we have to do to get rid of the corruption, Parker and Thad Brown, chief of detectives. And we'll come back to it at the future. Well, of course, they never did come back to it. Dad remained out of the country.
Was there any chatter in the family about this? About
not a word. No, nothing. I mean,
of course, they really seemed to be surprised. You went to your half sister and.
Well, yeah. I mean, and once I got into the DA files, they lay it out where I said, well, how can this happen? She couldn't have been murdered at the house because we live there. Well, I come to find out we weren't there. They interviewed my mom, which also I had the transcripts of, and we were living with her brother at the time for like a month. So he had the house all to himself when the murder went down, and there's no question that the murder occurred. I was able to even physically link physical evidence from the house to the crime scene. Dad used these 50-pound cement bags after he surgically bisected her in the tub, drained her blood and stuff at the house. He transports her in his car, but he places her on top of these 50-pound cement sacks, takes her to the crime scene, poses the body, and leaves these sacks near the body so that police link the sacks and they know the crime didn't occur there, but they didn't know where. And it turns out I was able to actually locate original receipts for these sacks, 50-pound sacks, at the UCLA library for receipts. Yeah. For Frank Lloyd Wright Jr., who was doing work for my father, reconstructing and repairing. And it was like the 3 days during that supposedly missing week, 3 days the receipts are dated during that time period. So it's like you've actually got physical evidence at the crime scene, and you've got the tape recordings, and it just goes on and on. Then the real kicker is I find out all four top cops with LAPD separately acknowledge that George Odell was the killer, and you know that they solved the case, but he fled the country. So I mean, it was just like unbelievable, massive amount of corroboration.
You know, it would seem that there would have been some kind of pressure put on the police to solve this case. You know, because there was so much.
Oh, it was huge pressure. But you know, they had the choice of, well, if this comes out, we're not going to be able to take power, and we want to clean up the department. You know, and Parker. You know, he's famous for cleaning up LAPD, you know, and he made that choice of, you know, George Odell's gone. You know, if we do bring him back, he's going to lay out a whole bunch of everything he knows about a whole lot of people. That ain't good, you know. And so it was like, it was the wrong choice, but it was the choice they made for the good of themselves, the good of the city, and, you know, the good of the department. So,
it seems like, you know, this would be an embarrassment to L.A., and so you'd think the police would be real excited about all this evidence. You did the work for them, and they would want to reopen the investigation. But have you gone to the police and What is this?
Oh, God, yes. I had a briefing. I had the top brass. I mean, the other kicker is, here we are, I mentioned that the chief of detectives at the time mm-hmm. was Thad Brown. Mm-hmm. So I joined the LAPD in 63. Of course, he's still a chief of detectives. I go to detectives, or I'm still in uniform at the time, and Parker dies of a heart attack. Thad Brown becomes the interim temporary chief. And I go in uniform. I go with a bunch of other guys from Hollywood to his swearing-in ceremony along with a couple of hundred other officers. Mm-hmm. And I'm there, and he gets sworn in. Of course, I have no clue about anything. And I'm in the auditorium, and then it's over, and I walk out, and I hear this officer. And I stop, turn around. Well, here's the chief Thad Brown and a photographer. And he says, "Would you like your picture taken with the chief?" And I said, "What's not to like?" You know, we step outside, have our picture taken. I go my way, he goes his way, and I don't have a clue. Well, of course, you know, later, of course, once this all unfolds, I will realize all along he knew that my dad, he couldn't resist the photo op. Mm-hmm. He knew my dad was, you know, the killer, the Black Dahlia murderer, and he just had to have that photo, and he sent, you know, interdepartment mail, he sent me a copy. And I threw it in a box and forgot about it for 40 years, having no realization of what it meant until I got into this.
So what happens now? What happens now? I mean,
what happens now? You know, LAPDs can't defeat the evidence. They know that. I gave them a briefing, and basically their position is, look, we're busy with current murders. We don't have time to go back 50 years into an unsolved and stuff. And, you know, again, it comes down to image run and, you know, mm-hmm. reputation. Parker and Thad Brown were the two greatest heroes on LAPD. They were my heroes. You know, they were on the job with me, and I loved them. And so they don't want to mess with this, and they can't defeat the evidence. So all they can do is say, we haven't got time to look at it. And that's what they're doing. And they've been saying that for now 20 years.
Well, how has it affected the family? I mean, are people ticked off at you, or they're excited about, you know,
You mean my family?
Yeah, your family, Ryan.
Yeah, well, it was mixed because Dad, you know, had 11 children by 5 different women, you know, had this amazing life. So it was, after he split, he raised 4 children had a family of 4 in the Philippines.
To have a IQ of Einstein, that's what your book says.
186 IQ, 1 point above Einstein. Child prodigy, played his own piano concerts at the Hollywood Bowl at the age of 9. You know, just on and on. Went to Caltech at 14, had an affair with a professor's wife. She got pregnant, broke up her marriage. She goes back east, has his child. Mm-hmm. He goes to medical school, pre-med at Berkeley, and then UCLA, UCSF. Has multiple affairs, multiple children, and then reinvents himself as a market research guy. Brilliant. And then there's a whole other aspect of this which we just don't have time to touch on, which has to do with, and it was his personal insanity, his madness, was murder is a fine art, which I present, which has to surround surrealism and the posing of the body after, you know, some surrealist photographs of his friend Man Ray. It just goes on and on. There's so many rabbit holes to this story.
It goes on and on, right, because you're still, doing projects. You've got a film project, right?
We're looking at putting together a mini series because, you know, 5 books, there's no way you can tell this in a 2-hour feature film. So I'm working with some really top people, some really cool guys, very well known, and we're putting it together, and we're currently in the process of, it looks like it's going to all come together, and not signed, sealed, and delivered yet, but everybody's very excited, and it'll be an amazing story when it's told right. It'll be a documentary, but also, you know, reenactments, that sort of thing. And everybody's excited, and it's just, you know, I'll tell you who's involved. It's T-Bone Burnett and Nick Pizzolatto, who was, you know, the true crime detective, you know, those series of the three. And and Rob Bindler, who's a documentarian, terrific guy. He's going to direct, and it really looks good. And it's just an amazing story. As Nick said, it's the Ulysses of true crime stories. I love that. You know,
five books are really amazing. Do you ever see yourself ending the research? Say, I've had enough of this case. I proved.
Yeah, I've been trying to get. You know, my boys. I have two sons, so I know they're worried. And said, Dad, get a life. You know, get out of this. This is ridiculous. You know, I mean. Well, you know, we're up to 25 murders through the 30 years, and now, sadly, he didn't wake up at age 39 and say, I think I'll be a serial killer. So I've got at least one more book to do, which is the early years, which he started as a teenager. So I have very strong connections to the crimes he committed back in the 20s and 30s. So, I wish I could get out of it, but it's like I got to finish what I started.
Exactly. But you must get some blowback. People can admire the research and your doggedness, but you must get some blowback from some people that don't like the fact.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's been a lot of people that say, there's no way that this can be true. You know, this guy is, how can this be? Well, and as long as it was me just saying it, they could argue it. But then, of course, in the DA secret DA files, we also have the connection that George Hodel was dating her. I mean, this is all documented in the secret police files. So whether that throws out the question of whether or not that photograph, because the big thing with people was that's not a photo of her. If that's not a photo of her, then the whole thing falls apart, which is not true. But anyway, it doesn't matter now. We can throw the photo out, even if it, I had a facial recognition guy do in Germany, top lab there, coming back 95%. It's her, but you need a 99.8 to make a positive.
Well, we're gonna have to stop it there, and we'll wait for that next book to come out. Quickly, we only got 20 seconds or so. How long will before that book comes out?
Well, I gotta focus on the movie, so the book's got a back seat for now, and we'll try and see if we can get the miniseries first, and then go from there.
Wow, on that then. Well, I wish you luck with all your endeavors,
thanks, Ron. It's been good talking with you, Bill.
Right, and thank you so much for being on the show. The book again is Dahlia Avenger. It's a true story, and it's written by Steve Hodel. It's a fascinating book, as I said. Great pictures too. You got some really good pictures in there on that.
Yeah.
And have a great evening, and hope to see you again soon.
Okay, stay hunkered down. Wear a mask.
that sounds like a good idea. Wow.
Okay.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the show tonight, folks. Next week we have Peter Walsh. We're going to go across the pond to Manchester, England, and he's going to talk about his book, Drug War, A Secret History. It's a really good book. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. And please spread the word about our show. Until next week, we hope you tune in to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you'll want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Sleep tight, everybody.